There were 5 minutes to go when Gideon's 87th escape plan got messed up fantastically. "I see that your genius strategy, Griddle," said a final voice from the tierway, "was to order a shuttle and walk out the door." The lady of the ninth house stood before the drill shaft, wearing black and sneering. Reverend daughter Herahark Nonagesimus had pretty much cornered the market on wearing black and sneering. It comprised 100% of her personality. Gideon marveled that someone could live in the universe only 17 years and yet wear black and sneer with such ancient self-assurance. Gideon said, "Hey, what can I say? I'm a tactician."
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, Episode 2,
A Fair Fight.
Welcome back. I'm Claire Beans, artist, educator, and big fucking nerd.
I'm Han Kaylee, also a nerd.
We are here with our second episode of the Nunpod Left Grief podcast, doing our chapter by chapter read through and commentary and analysis of Gideon the Ninth, and more to come. Hopefully this continues to be super fun.
Thank you to everyone for the incredibly warm reception for our first episode. We're really, really excited by all of the feedback that we've gotten, and share this with somebody whose life you want to ruin.
I have a funny scheme of introducing someone to the book at least one time as a way of inviting them as guests, and that may happen next week. Who knows? We have started already talking to people that we know within the fandom about guesting, and if you are really invested in the idea of participating in that, reach out to us. We've talked about how to get to know people who are volunteering from kind of outside our known circles. And if that's something you're stoked about, maybe we could do something about that.
Also, if you have fan art that you would love to see featured on the show, especially if it portrays a particular moment in the plot, reach out to us, because we would love to feature your art.
Oh yeah. I just want to see it. Send me this art that you think is amazing. Like either that you made or that you have in your like locked tomb memes and like heart crimes folder. Share with us so that we can share that with the world.
Yeah, tag hashtag nunpod on anything just to show us stuff. We would like to see the stuff. Chapter one was 2 hours long as Gideon was waiting for the shuttle. Chapter two takes place in 5 minutes. There's 3 minutes of talking and 2 minutes of fighting.
And it's also very different, like internal monologue pacing. Mm-hmm. Like there's all this like reflectiveness and larger observation of the environment, but also it's paced to give us this idea of the kind of leisurely energy that Gideon had that morning. And now suddenly things are very pressured.
Yeah. There's this sense of, there was that languorousness of the waiting, even in these, you know, unpleasant encounters with like Lamine and Crux. And now it is action.
Yeah. Yeah. And okay, do you think that Harrow has chosen to keep Eglamine and Crux from physically bringing, because I'm sure Crux would be perfectly happy to like drag Gideon to the assembly. Like Harrow has clearly chosen this confrontation, but was it because she had to?
I don't think she did have to. I think that this is a choice. And this is something that I noticed in rereading this chapter after our conversation last week, was Crux, as we discussed, is really oriented to Gideon as an object. She's a tool. She's not a very good tool. She'll be a better tool when she's dead. And that's his whole feelings on the matter. Eglamine is like, she's actually an okay tool as long as you use her for fighting. And these are both like really objectifying stances. And the interesting thing about Harrow is that Harrow is obviously a complete asshole to Gideon. She's treating her terribly, but she's treating her like a person. Her orientation is not domination and force It is manipulation. It is about knowing her and understanding her and having this intensely intimate theory of mind of what makes Gideon tick, what will Gideon think and feel in the moment, which is profoundly humanizing, despite the fact that it's also a horrible, mean trick where she beats the shit out of her.
Yeah, and it's a horrible, mean trick in which Harrow means to give Gideon an enormous amount of sense of agency, but like it is written right in there. Gideon is like, this is a fucking trap. Harrow really wants Gideon to say yes. Like Harrow knows that she can force Gideon to say yes. Harrow's done this before. She understands her game plan, but like Harrow really wants it.
I think this manipulation and violation and force is rooted in this fear of rejection and this fundamental cowardice where like she could have a non-violating relationship with Gideon, but she would need to be so much more vulnerable. And she is willing to pretend to be vulnerable in order to employ force, but she's not willing to actually be vulnerable.
Yeah.
She wants a yes, but she's not going to ask the question because she is too afraid.
That longing that we, you know, chew on through the whole everywhere, we're first seeing it in Harrow. Like Gideon's like, yeah, no, I'm done. I'm gone. Like Gideon is not going to even think about Harrow, which is so ironic given that like Harrow's the one who's like, I don't even think about you.
Oh, that line in this chapter is upsetting. It's a lie, and it's an upsetting lie.
Does Harrow do this because of the call from the first? Or does the timing just line up really well? Because I'm actually not clear on that.
My suspicion, although this is not textually, you know, provable, is Harrow doesn't want to take orders to the first.
And it just happened to be that Gideon is trying to escape close to when she is having to make this decision. So Harrow waited for Gideon to have another escape attempt. Do you think Harrow would have missed Gideon? If the escape attempt had succeeded and there had not been any summons and it was just another day and now it's her and Ordis and the rest of the ninth?
I think yes. I think she wouldn't have been able to recognize that that's what she was feeling. And I think she would have gotten real weird.
Mm-hmm. I'm getting some like Miss Havisham energy, maybe real weird.
I don't get that reference.
There is, I believe it's a Dickens. There is a character in a story from this period of this wealthy, isolated woman who was betrayed by her groom at the altar. And she like, forever, like she leaves the giant banquet in the great hall and she lives in her decaying hair and wedding dress years later, and like she lives frozen in this moment of loss, and she becomes increasingly like defined by it while also denying its importance to her. This comes up kind of in Harrow, really, that way of grieving without knowing about it by becoming slowly weirder and more unhinged.
I like that this fight scene, and I mostly mean the verbal fight that they have rather than the physical fight, sets up kind of the core tragedy of their relationship. Because Gideon accurately understands that Harrow is impulsive to the point of self-destructiveness, but she does not recognize that she also is.
Gideon sees a button and wants to press it. Gideon sees a giant fucking skelly monster and wants to fight it. Like, let's take this shit head on, regardless of whether or not we have time to consider for an alternative. Like, there's like when they're on the first, they're not in, yes, there's a bit of an urgency, but the degree to which Gideon charges into things, I don't know, it's almost actually a little bit in contrast to the like very slow, methodical Gideon that we get in chapter one. Gideon's like, let's fucking do this. Like, let's fucking do this. Like, it's Harrow challenging for the fight in this scene.
Yeah,
not
and
Gideon.
I think Gideon and Harrow are interesting foils in that aspect of their personalities because they both have the meticulous, dedicated grind in them, and they also both have the rabid impulsivity.
Either of them might start that fight at any time, and it just was a roll of the dice. Who it was this time.
I always assume that Harrow starts the fight every time.
Interesting. Because there's also a thing where, you know, has Harrow directly challenged Gideon to a fight before?
Yes.
At least once.
At least once. We also know that Harrow has done unilateral violence to Gideon. Like, Gideon doesn't benefit from challenging Harrow to a fight.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Harrow had to present herself as uniquely vulnerable in order to make that tempting, because
yeah.
that's not a tempting offer for Gideon under normal circumstances.
Yeah. Harrow very much had to telegraph relinquishing power.
Yeah.
You're right. Gideon would never chose that fight. Gideon would fight Crux every time because it's funny.
Yeah. Even
like,
though
that,
he beats her.
that is like, so we have like it being funny is a good enough reason. So maybe Gideon has like picked a fight with Harrow before, but only because it was funny, knowing the fact that she's going to suffer for it afterwards.
I would
That's
buy that.
Plausible. That's
I would buy
plausible.
That for sure.
Do you think when Harrow dismisses, so Gideon's like, this is crazy. I have shit on you, so go fuck yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then Harrow's like, you know, waves away the retainers and sycophants and whatever. So is this threat from Gideon, is her being in this now vulnerable position where Gideon could say it right now. Gideon could start talking right now, right? Like, her retainers, like, I don't think they're really a threat to Harrow's position socially, but they don't understand what and who Harrow is. They don't understand the reality of the leadership of the Ninth. Harrow recognizes the risk.
Do they not know?
They don't. I don't think so. Otherwise, why would Harrow dismiss them?
I thought somebody knew. I thought Crux knew.
So this is one of those, okay. There is a play. It's the Alas, Poor Yorick speech, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's changed contextually depending on whether there is another party hiding and listening to this exposition.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, not being certain about whether or not there are other people in this moment who are aware of what and who Harrow is and what is going on within the Lord and Lady of Gerbera in general. Like, I could see a Clarks and Aglemine absolutely going along with it, for sure. They have nothing to lose by doing so. They have nothing to gain by not doing so.
Yeah, because they're super loyal to the house. And so I would imagine that both of them would just be like, well, we're here now. This is what we gotta do.
Then who is the threatened audience of Gideon's confession?
Definitely the world beyond the Ninth House.
So Gideon has the capacity to have limited contact with the outside world clandestinely.
The way I imagined this threat working was, you're going to let me go and you're not going to tell anybody that my release form was forged, because now that I'm on Trentham, I could tell everybody. So I mean, she obviously has some capacity to contact a shuttle.
Yeah.
We know that it was difficult for her to get that capacity. So like, she could get a message out maybe if she tried.
Yeah.
Although it might take her months.
And Gideon also really isn't in a position to like make that delivered and distributed in a way that would make any fucking difference.
No.
Like,
Gideon
like,
is assuming
cares?
That people would believe her and care.
like if we think to, you know, zoom out to this larger space empire thing, like the meaning of why the Ninth is important is A, obscured from basically everybody who's not in the innermost circle. And I would imagine, in contrast to that, has been turned into a backwater where you put prisons and dying people. Like, this is a really effective strategy to make sure people don't dig in this space.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we have some familiarity with characters from like the third and the seventh, it's easy to imagine people like Iante hearing that the ninth house princess has been secretly puppeting her dead parents and just going, dope. what's she gonna say? She's gonna be like, nice. That's so weird. Gross.
You know what? Yeah, that's Moriante's response. I could also, like, I think my brain filled in Nibirius's response, which is just like being like generally kind of creeped out and disgusted by anything to do with the way the ninth does, and being unsurprised at any kind of implied degeneracy, implied depravity.
We have another little moment of materials coming up as important, because we are introduced to the idea that paper is very precious and rare and only used for really special things.
Yes, I did observe that. And so I thought one thing about that is that why would there be any paper manufacturing on the ninth?
Yeah, there's probably no trees.
It doesn't explicitly say no trees, but it sure as hell gives no trees energy.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine rocks for sure. I don't imagine trees.
Like we have a bubble prison in the sky, and we have a massive crevasse down into the earth, and we have like skeletons being the agricultural workers because it's not a job for living people.
Yeah. We don't get introduced to flimsy yet, which we later learn is like the primary paper alternative. We're never told what flimsy is made of, but I want to ask you, I've heard two major theories.
Okay.
Plastic and vellum. Is flimsy made out of people, or is it made out of plastic?
Plastic is treated more so while people's individual agency, both during their lives and after, is clearly eroded in this world, people are still treated like a carefully managed resource. I don't think anything to do with that would end up being called flimsy.
Mm.
And I think the flimsy being maybe a like post-consumer plastic product that's low quality that can't be used for anything else, like, you know, we're in the future, we're still using plastics. Okay, so just some conclusions we can come to. Earth is borderline uninhabitable. We have found oil or oil-like substances on other planets. We have colonized other spaces because the initial spaces that we evolved within couldn't coexist with widespread plastic use. So we now must have some kind of industrial system that continues to maintain making plastic that is not worth even recognizing. Mm-hmm. So it's on some other planet somewhere.
Yeah.
So we have a very like pollution exported to the global south kind of situation. And when I think of this, I very much think of Nona. I think of the quality of life of the people in Nona's space. And I'm like, yeah, it could be there. Like this gives, you know, kids picking through garbage, like kids going through midden piles and their job being pulling out electronics, like that gives that kind of energy that space does.
I agree.
Yeah, my guess would be like post-consumer materials that were unusable otherwise. And yeah. I don't know a lot about plastics manufacturing. I'm not a chemical engineer. If we have any chemical engineers who want to like tweet their or what, however people talk to each other on the internet, to tell us your thoughts on what like a industrial.
I will say if you tweet at us, neither of us will ever know.
Yeah, that's true. I am available on Instagram. Han is available on TikTok. Good luck. And
Facebook.
Oh yeah, technically I'm kind of, anyway. So if you're a person who understands the industrial processes behind recycling and wants to give us your two cents on this theory, we'd love to hear. But I do think of when I hear flimsy, I think of those in my city now banned plastic garbage bags, the like really lightweight ones, that, you know, all of us who have cats were like, God damn it. Like there goes my cat shit bags, but it's very flimsy. It's single use. But I also think of like the ways in which paper is flimsy and it's flimsy because of the way we handle it. So flimsy plastic, a la those plastic crinkly bags that we put groceries in 10 years ago, that is a different kind of flimsy than cellulose paper.
Mm-hmm.
Cellulose paper is made of very short fibers that have been wiggled all together and stacked and compressed. They're flimsy once they have been bent several times. So the way that that paper is stored is critical to its longevity. So whatever Hera is holding, it has been scrolled. It is very unlikely that it has been folded, because mm-hmm. we can look at history's use of paper, and a lot of our preservation of paper is by either keeping it flat and bound at the edge or in scrolls. Like, we have these ways of keeping it so it doesn't fold.
Did you catch that the commission wouldn't work?
Because it hasn't been signed in blood yet, or for a different reason?
There's a moment where Gideon and Harrow talk about the fact that Gideon signed Harrow's name to her initial release, and Harrow signs her mother's name. And she talks about how you can't forge it because it's signed in blood. And then she signs it in blood. But whose blood does she sign it in?
Oh, interesting.
If it matters whose blood it is, if blood is an anti-forgery mechanism, which, side note, cool as hell, extremely necromantic, very good vibes.
And like, we could do that. We have the technology to make that happen now, but carry on.
Right. The idea that there's a biometric element to a contract being signed in blood, totally plausible. That completely makes sense on a technological
Absolutely.
Level.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Harrow signs her mother's name in her blood.
So Harrow makes the contract legally compromised. Yeah, I didn't catch that. And it's the way that Harrow conceives of forgery is really interesting and really highlighted in that moment, because it's like Harrow's entire existence is a forgery. And this call to muster is like asking her to like next level up her forgery work. And like, Gideon's counter to this is to say, like, fuck you, I will tell them all you're a fraud.
Mm-hmm. In the course of the conversation between Gideon and Harrow, we learn a little bit more about how the military fits into the colonial economy. We know from chapter one that indentured servants have the right to enlist, which Gideon is asserting that this is her right. But in this chapter, we learn that enlistment means freedom from indenture with 30 years of service or 5 years of service with the commission.
We're looking at ambition that Gideon would never have even considered. Harrow knows that the ranking, the recognition, the power, the nice stuff, the babes, like Harrow knows Gideon's levers.
The difference between 30 years and 5 years is so big.
It's a whole lifetime, really.
I mean, it's more than Gideon's lifetime so far.
Yeah. Yeah.
An extra 25 years in the military, being in the military in forever war, 25 years is so long. That's a fake amount. That's not an amount. Like, as we get to know the fort
sentence.
And stuff.
Like, the only thing where I hear contractual obligations to that degree are lifetime prison sentences. Speaking of fuck prisons, like, an indentured servitude of 25 years is basically life. If it's in military, almost guaranteed. Because Gideon is not going to be going, like, outside of Harrow's commissioned offer, which isn't going to happen. Gideon is not going to be going to the safe spaces, like, where, you know, she'll be pushing paper or training, like, you know, initiates. Like, Gideon is going to be on the front lines, and 25 years, like, we love a Glamine.
30 years.
30 years.
Yeah.
30 years.
25 on top of the commissioned amount. Yeah.
So Gideon's going to be doing this for 30 years, theoretically, but, like, looking just at what being in war does to your body and mind, like, a Glemmine is obviously a war veteran.
Mm-hmm.
Like, gives big war. A Glemmine is fucking broken.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that a Glemmine is alive is framed by the archetype as being extraordinary. And it is made obvious that it has come at a very high cost.
And there's no way she did 30 years.
Yeah. She and it that would mean that she would have a short, reasonable, livable period of time doing more direct frontline combat, and then would be pushed to a more either administrative or tactician or an analyst, like these other roles that these pipelines. I've got a friend who joined the military, and they had like a 7-year plan of the different cities that he would move to and the different people that he'd replace. Like, these things are highly engineered. So Aglemine's injuries came early on because she wouldn't have been in that much risk after, I want to even say, like, 2 years of active service is a long time.
I live in a different country from you.
Okay. What is a long time of active service in your country?
I've heard of people, I mean, you're not in active service the whole time, but I've heard of people doing 6 months in a war zone every 2 years for several years.
So this is also an interesting way of looking at it. As an indentured servant, would Gideon have access to what would be framed as a more sustainable workload, a more sustainable pattern, or would be just thrown right into the meat grinder until meat got grinded?
I mean, I think given what happened to the bad teen's parents, for sure we're throwing people into meat grinders. The way that I read Aglamine's implicit story is less that like she did her time and got moved out, and more that she got lucky in that her injury was bad enough to make her not useful on the front lines anymore, but not bad enough to kill her.
Honorably discharged.
Not necessarily honorably discharged. I think you're right that she could very much have spent the rest of her years at a desk every army has way more support roles than it has combat roles. And I'm sure that's true of John's army as well. But I think of it less that, yeah, that she, you know, served her time and got to be done with combat, and more just that she wasn't useful for combat and she didn't happen to die of it.
I wonder if that's part of, you know, her empathy towards Gideon, is she's like, oh, this is, I also want this one to not die of it.
Yeah, I kind of view her attitude towards Gideon enlisting as like, yeah, I get it, but like, are you sure?
Yeah, like I can see how Aglemine would be pretty torn of like seeing Gideon have a degree of freedom. I think would be really rewarding, especially given the fact that she has given up on ever getting off the ninth. So there's a bit of like extending, seeing her own story somehow redeemed. But knowing just how fucking lucky she was to even get broken and permanently on the night, like that's lucky. Gideon is, in my impression, like, I don't think Gideon aged Aglemine was as much of like a doofus as Gideon aged Gideon is. I think their personalities are fundamentally different, and Gideon is going to do more stupid shit, and Aglemine knows that.
Yeah. Yeah. Gideon has big run into battle energy that
you
don't know whether Aglemine ever had.
That is, I think, the thing that really drew me to Gideon personally is the, like, I think of some of the stupid things that I have done, and I'm like, Gideon would be like, that would be absolutely the coolest shit to do with Gideon.
We do get confirmation that the houses receive war spoils when a member of their house enlists. So we see a reference to how resources are moving from the colonial periphery toward the metropole.
I'm assuming that the colonization technique is the same as what we see in Druber, which is a limited range artificial environment designed to make the most of what we are already doing. So we're using like earth, plants, like this does not give the vibe of a culture that's like, we're going to go to a planet and figure out how to go with what's there. No, this is the vibe of, we're going to go to a planet, we're going to raise, you know, 100 square miles and then put a bubble over it and then mine the rest. And then, you know, the one that looks like a beautiful pleasure planet, we're going to make into a beautiful pleasure planet and turn that into some sort of institutionalized part of our identity. None of this is shocking, right? The idea that this world exists never really comes as a shock. even prison babies, like, it lands like a punch in the gut, but it doesn't land like a surprise. And so when I think of all the different, like, familiarities, not that I can, like, pinpoint an example, but if I think of, like, a pleasure planet, we have, like, resort spaces, we have the places in which we do those things now have really specific economic patterns in terms of, like, who lives there, who profits, and who has no idea about the dynamic of the area.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if they want your money, they're not going to tell you the reality of it. The people who are living there are having a bad time.
Yeah.
And the people who are profiting are living over either at the top of their palace on the pleasure planet or somewhere else entirely, like the Mithraeum.
I am thinking of Jamaica and Hawaii as kind of clear examples of where, like, the local population is having a really different experience from the tourist population or the non-local owners of the tourist-serving industries.
Yeah. We don't have a lot of conversations around, like, indigenous alien populations. I think this is not that kind of sci-fi, but someone has to be playing that role within this economy. Like, you're talking about the military economy, there's always more support roles than there is front combat roles. And there's also, like, more roles upholding this higher social hierarchy than the people who are benefiting from it, right?
Right. I think the ninth gives us an interesting picture of that because there's obviously this very profound social inequality on the ninth, but then there's also this additional layer of the ninth benefiting from this broader geographic social inequality of, you know, the resources moving from these terrorist controlled planets towards the good, wholesome empire planets.
Yeah, the good, wholesome empire planets that each have very, very strong identity and narrative, and where tradition is extremely important in maintaining that identity and narrative.
I think part of the value of having our POV character be Gideon, who is in a shit position on the shittiest of the power planets, is it gives readers from the US and similar countries an in to be like, you might be in kind of a shitty position in your world power, but your world power is also putting you in this privileged position. And, like, even in your shitty position, you are still benefiting from the exploitation of others that you are structurally not allowed to notice.
That to me immediately strikes in terms of the quality of psychological and spiritual existence of the people inside and outside these systems. Nona is a much happier book. It is heartbreaking. Don't get me wrong. Heart crimes abound. But, like, Nona's family unit, Nona's day-to-day life is that of someone who is not bought into that. This is this elaborate institutionalized structure in which everyone is kind of miserable. And in these places that are, in fact, far more simple in their kind of, they are to me much more anarchistic. Things are organized at a smaller scale. Things are more responsive to local events happening. Communication happens person to person in ways that are based on interpersonal relationships and trust rather than on institutions and centralized information sources. There is a kind of care for each other that goes beyond just liking someone. It's kind of like, okay, this is part of what we do here. Nona is a book with more tenderness and kindness, I think, because it's possible to, in ways that would never be possible for Gideon or Harrow to ever experience. The kinds of tenderness and care that we see there is just, like, not possible inside Empire.
And I think that that's a lot of what Mirror is doing with this series, is exploring how do you love within Empire? And all of the characters are trying to figure that out in different ways.
Yeah. There's both a kind of hope and a kind of, and a comfort in that of being like, wow, these people do not get it right, but they're the ones that we are meant to relate to.
Yeah, because we are also trying and failing.
From being deeply embedded in this.
It's interesting to me at the moment that Harrow offers the commission that Gideon actually shows us as the reader that she understands that Harrow values her, because she's like, why would Harrow give up owning me? You know, this sacrifice that she's making, she describes it as shooting herself in the foot and then taking aim to shoot herself in the other foot. And so Gideon does not understand herself in the way that Crux frames her as this useless chattel who will only be useful when she's dead. She views herself as a prized resource to the house from Harrow's position.
Yeah. And is that because she is young? Is that because she is capable in a way that no one else is at this point physically? Is it the emotional intimacy that is shared between them that, like, Gideon's like, yeah, this bitch couldn't exist without me. Like, she wouldn't have someone to be mean to. Like, Harrow needs the emotional catharsis of taking out all of her anxiety on Gideon.
Yeah, I think the why is a really good question. And it suggests that Gideon has been receiving messages from Harrow that are very different from the messages she gets from Michael Imanae and Crux.
Yeah.
And we know that some of those messages are obscene, brutal violence. But the fact that she views herself as being really valuable to Harrow and indispensable to Harrow suggests that there's also something else that she's hearing from her.
Yeah, and it suggests that she has seen Harrow vulnerable, because she talks about the blood sweat, how easy and quickly Gideon realizes how far Harrow is pushing herself.
Mm-hmm.
She has seen Harrow escalate things beyond her capacity before. And we will come to see about how quickly and easily Gideon comes to Harrow's rescue in those situations. So I imagine this is, like, in terms of extending herself through necromancy, Gideon being there somehow when Harrow has pushed herself physiologically and magically too far, like, that's also a thing that's happened before. And it's interesting that, you know, Aglemini, Crux, Ordis, like, why isn't there anyone, I guess after her parents died, there wasn't really anyone to do that mentorship role in terms of necromancy and, like, self-regulation of use of magic. There's no guidance there at all. So she's just constantly on edge, pushing herself to where she might feel like she has control over a situation.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the game that I think she describes in the second book, of pushing on her finger bones to the point where they are almost going to break. And that just being a normal way that she did things from early childhood.
Pain stimming. Harrow's very personalized representation of her medium. Harrow experiments on herself very readily. And probably, I mean, as a child going through bookshelves and bookshelves of necromancy, having no friends to, you know, talk about that kind of thing with. Like, as a kid, you're like, oh, I discovered a secret. Like, you tell someone because you want to, it's thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
7-year-old kid is a 7-year-old kid. Even if they are, like, very high control, they're still going to want to explore. And exploring is part of exploring at that age is sharing. So all Harrow had was herself to explore with. Like, she's like, oh, okay. So, like, what would be ways that a child would first practice necromancy?
Play fighting.
Oh, fuck.
She had somebody to show.
Oh my God. I always forget about all of the layers to that fight, that I'm sure when we get to the chapter that refers to their childhood fight, there will be lots of interesting things to talk about there. I do like Harrow's theatrics in removing all of her bone accessories. I think it's in the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock Holmes thing. I haven't seen much of it, but there's this one scene where he, like, walks into this room where, like, the nemesis is or whatever, and it's just this very attractive woman wearing no clothes.
I remember that scene.
And she's like, now you've seen my battle armor. And it's the same kind of thing where it's like stripped down is in fact unencumbered. It's an ante up that says, I'm so fucking sure that I'm gonna win this one. I don't need it.
You know, the almost at the crux. the central pivot of the trick is that she is so emotional, that she's become impulsive, that she's self-sacrificing, that she's become irrational and sloppy and desperate. And that is what convinces Gideon to take the trap that she knows is a trap. And yeah. Hera was only able to successfully convince Gideon of this moment because she is like that.
Yeah. So this can really be related to the concept of feints in martial arts and combat. Yeah. Like if your stimulus, so let's say you are in a combat with someone and you want to fuck with them and you have a shot in mind, but you're kind of not there yet. You're not positioned in relationship with them. That'll give you that opportunity. You can start pushing someone's space with a feint, which is like a threatened, pretended attack. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, a feint won't work if it's not actually a threat. Like, it needs to be something that people will respond to. And, like, Harrow not only understands the nature of Gideon's escape to join the military, has gone above and beyond Gideon's own ambitions for herself to be like, no, I can't just show up and be willing to let Gideon go. I have to actually up the ante. So, like, Gideon does understand that Harrow is a fraud, but, like, clearly they remain emotional enough in their moments of adolescence, because, like, 17 and 18, like, we're looking at this age where you are still, your brain is still growing enormously quickly. You are so porous to culture. You are so deeply invested in your worldview while also deeply curious about the world. But there's not really the ability to know your own faults at that point. Like, the kinds of pitfalls that we repeatedly fall in that we made for ourselves, like, you don't know them when you're a teenager. Like, you definitely start finding them then.
Do you think that they've started? Because Gideon knows that she's going to fall for the trick.
Yeah.
And Harrow knows that she is impulsive and gets weird and desperate and just becomes a goblin. And so she performs goblin in order to do the trick.
Yeah, yeah. Great example of calm, like, coolly delivered goblin, which I think is an underrepresented goblin variant.
Yeah.
But a very good and interesting one, because I didn't think of it. It doesn't come with the chaotic exterior that often the chaotic interior will come with.
Yeah. Yeah, she is an extremely high protocol goblin.
And it's interesting because there is this great loneliness in that way of being.
Mm.
It's so tender when you get a slight sight of the vulnerability behind that high control.
I love about Gideon that she understands immediately that she has lost and she fights her heart out anyway.
Yeah.
She's a very smart fighter. She understands as soon as she perceives her miscalculation, she's like, oh, I lose this fight. And then she fights her hardest for 2 minutes, which under the circumstances is actually very impressive.
Cardio wise, that's a long ass time in a fight.
I wasn't even thinking cardio wise. I was just thinking, have you been in a melee that is vastly outnumbered where it's one person genuinely fighting against a bunch of people?
Well, one time I got charged by a herd of cattle, and that was something like that.
Yeah. I don't know how many skeletons Gideon is fighting, but if it's more than three, 2 minutes is a good fight.
Yeah. Gideon's previously referred to workout regimen is really being like, no, Gideon needs this because Gideon is regularly fighting several skeletons because they're regularly fighting Harrow for fucking kicks. Like, we can, like, I want to say, okay, we know there's at least one other time they fought. Usually it's Harrow starting it, which means that Harrow's bringing the skeletons involved, and Gideon's also going to be fighting for kicks, knowing what to expect, which is a bunch of skeletons. So, like, Gideon's fought this bout before. Maybe this is one of the reasons why Gideon trains so hard, is because she's like, I'm going to have to fight those fucking skeletons again.
Yeah, and Gideon knows how many skeletons she can't defeat. She saw the amount of skeletons and went, well, that's it.
Yeah.
that's not an amount that I can do.
Yeah. Yeah. I was in a wrestling tournament once, and I was, at the time, 225 pounds. I was the only woman and the smallest person in my bracket. The others were all big, muscly dudes. And I knew that the odds of me getting takedowns the way that I wanted them, I had never trained with people that size. I was in my club the largest person in a lot of ways. But what I could do was give them a really bad time. And the like inherent satisfaction of like, I've accepted my fate and you don't know what the fuck I'm going to do next because my goals have changed.
I am the same person as you and I got my rib broken that way once.
My nose is normal one way and then it just like is flat the other way because my face got so smeared into the ground. The consequences of our actions.
Anyway, Gideon, highly relatable to actual sword case.
Gideon, highly relatable. And it's, I have a friend of a friend who knows the model who was the cover of the first book. Mm-hmm. The sword world is a small world.
Yeah.
If you know two people, you know everybody. And so, like, Tasman Muir, like, is obsessive. And it's like, I would love to have been a fly on the wall in the conversations she was having while probably playing with swords with some sword fighters to be like, okay, so you have a long sword and there's three skeletons around. What would you do? And then just like keep on, like their friend is like, they're kind of calculating. And like Tasimir just like keeps on throwing conceptual skeletons at them until they're like, I don't know. And then it's just like, they're come up from the ground. They grab your feet. What do you do? And I'm like, I don't know. Like there's seven of them. Like doing multiple person melee combat is cognitively exhausting, mm-hmm. as well as physiologically exhausting. Like with one person, you're trying to manipulate where someone is in space. With multiple people, you're trying to manipulate how they relate to each other in space, as well as you.
And going back to the theory of mind problem, you're not actually fighting seven guys. You're fighting one guy with 14 hands and 14 legs.
Yeah. And you're also telling a story to one guy.
Yeah.
Like you're telling that one guy who he is. And that is the actual thing that you have control over in a multiple melee situation is the relationship that you are projecting. Like whatever the larger context is like there's something in a fight that pauses reality for a second and zooms into this super, super intimate space where you can fuck with someone in a very personal way that you wouldn't be able to otherwise within the container of the combat. And part of that is storytelling who you are in relationship to the other person. And controlling a group of people is making one person think that, making seven people think they are only one person. And
oh, I just meant that in this case, there's one person who's driving all of the skeletons. So they don't have individual minds.
That's right. I thought they had individual minds. I was wrong. It is one guy with 14 hands.
I'm thinking about, okay, when have I been in a melee situation and where like I am a little bit alone or a little bit isolated from my group and I'm facing a group together. And I'm thinking of, okay, there's four people who are making decisions about how to relate to each other and me. And that's not the situation Gideon is in.
No, that's not. There are not other people making decisions, which slows things down. There is only one person making decisions and they have already made a decision. They already know. They have made a decision yesterday.
And my reading of this chapter is that this was the exact thing that Gideon was worried about, because the first thing that we see her do in this chapter is look around for stuff.
Yeah.
She looks around behind the light and she kicks apart dirt clumps. She's like, there could be hidden skeletons, and she is comforted by not finding them. And it's because she didn't think that they would be buried in the dirt.
Yeah. And it mentions like until she's satisfied is kind mm-hmm. of the way that it's phrased. Like this is, she is unsettled until she has done this enough to reassure this could actually work.
What that tells me is that Harrow has done this more sloppily in the past. And this is an upped ante.
And enough that Gideon isn't even suspicious of an upped ante. Well, I mean, mm-hmm. except with the commission, obviously, but
yeah.
We are working on ground that has such an upped ante, it catches Gideon off guard. After 86 attempts, this is an this is an unprecedented escalation on Harrow's part.
The sentence Gideon had always known that this would be how she went gangbanged to death by skeletons goes so hard, and I appreciate it very much.
It's phenomenal, and it implies that this visual, this has gone through Gideon's head before.
Yeah, I think for sure this tells us that she has lost this fight before under different circumstances, which, like we said, like she understood on sight that she was about to lose this fight, but she has imagined that this is how she was going to die, and she thinks that she's about to die.
She thinks that she's about to die. Do you think she, really? Because, no, I don't think she thinks she's about to die.
I not only think that she thinks she's about to die, I also think she's right.
In this fight.
I think she dies on the way down to Druber after this fight, yeah. She gets a lot of head trauma, and then she passes out, and then she wakes up and she's okay. Which, like, that does happen. You can pass out from head trauma and then be okay. But I personally hold the theory that Gideon has died many times and that we see that referenced as if it's a joke. And I think maybe it's just not a joke. And this is the first instance in the text where I think that that happens.
In the like, it is very hard to kill Gideon. Gideon has died many times.
I think that she actually dies and then it doesn't stick.
Where are Gideon's mom's bones? Unrelated. Where are Gideon's mom's bones?
Gideon's mom's bones are growing snow leaks.
Are growing snow leaks.
I assumed. I don't know why I believe that to be true, but I feel very confident about it.
Okay.
The way that I understand it is apparently Gideon's mother was interred for a while, which I assume was to give her time to decompose and skeletonize. And then once she was skeletonized, she was raised to be in service of the house as all of the other skeletons are.
Right. And Gideon's indenturedness is an extension of Gideon's mother's indenturedness, as in incurring a debt by landing on the planet.
I don't even know if her mother's status was that formal. I think they were like, well, we got a dead lady.
It just indentured to me carries with it this implication of economic obligation.
I wonder, I guess I didn't assume that like when the great aunts died, their bones would not also just grow snow leaks. I just assumed they did it to everybody.
Yeah, I guess I guess whether or not your bones grow snow leaks and whether or not your economic and social status is related to the death of your space parent.
Yeah, maybe there is a class distinction though, because we see so much religious decoration, I don't know if that's how to say it, with bones, both in Druber and on the Mithraeum, that it seems like there's a pretty widespread practice of like decorating with skulls. So maybe having your skull become part of the temple rather than grow snow leaks is kind of a class benefit.
Okay, so your rights to your body during life are determined by economic status. Generally in this world, my understanding is this is, and I think you and I have talked about this before, this world never bothered with racism and homophobia.
That seems to be the case. Or if they did, all vestiges have been eliminated over the 10,000 years or so, John tells us. I have my doubts.
There's no reason to ever trust John about anything.
Rule number one, God lies.
Rule number one, God lies. I my favorite thing is fighting God. Like, and there's a reason why it's useful. Because you got to practice because God continues to lie. I feel one of the things I'm excited about doing this with you is that I have so many questions that you're like, oh no, there's an answer for that.
Some of the answers are heresy. Some of them are just that I've read the book 18 times, but some of them are personal heresies.
And that's one of my favorite things about you is heresy.
Thank you.
It's necessary.
Podcast of heretical secrets. Gideon says in this chapter for the first time that she has given Harrow her whole life, which obviously she will over and over again, and be horrified that Harrow rejects it over and over again. And Gideon refuses to give Harrow more, which she will continue to do again and again. So we see this setup of like, I have already given you everything and I'm not giving you a single other thing. And Harrow is like, yes, you will. Yes, you will. You will.
How do you think blood sweat works?
I guess the thing that I have imagined with blood sweat is kind of similar to bruising, but like harder. Like the stress maybe is increasing blood pressure in a way that is pushing some of the blood out of the veins and kind of into the tissue. And it's being expelled through the sweat rather than kind of just pooling and becoming a bruise.
Yeah.
Do we see anybody else do blood sweat? Is that something that we know is normal and not just Harrow's weird body?
I don't know. Hashtag nunpod. I don't know if that's just a Harrow's weird body thing, because you get examples of like people getting nosebleeds from exertion, people right. popping a blood vessel. So it implies that there is this intercellular pressure happening.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I've never been clear on is the difference between thanergy and thallergy, but my brain wants to create an elaborate system of how these energies play on the body. I don't understand Muir's magic system, but I know that it is internally consistent, because her writing is generally internally consistent.
I feel like I have looked up what the difference between thanergy and thallergy is a million times, and every time I look it up, I'm like, oh, okay. And I still don't know. It's in the back of the book. We can look it up right now and do it again.
Yeah, let's look it up. Okay, you're looking in the book.
Okay.
I'm going to look on Tumblr. Okay, I've got a locked tomb glossary here in front of me.
Okay, great.
All right. Thallergy and thanergy. Thallergy is the energy of life and is produced by cellular reproduction and growth. Most living beings are thallergic in character, including living beings and naturally occurring planets. Thanergy is the energy of death and is produced by cellular death and decay. The planets of the nine houses are thanergic in character, in particular. Living beings produce a shock of thanergy when they die, which necromancers are able to harness. The easiest way to remember the difference: thallergy has an L for life, and thanergy has an N for necrosis.
Oh, nice. That's actually going to be really helpful.
Yeah. Thank you to Sometimes Love Is Enough on Tumblr. So is her tissue dying from magic overclocking, or is her tissue like overclocking from overclocking?
Creating death energy? I don't know.
There could be an argument made that every cell has a thallergic and a thanergic state. I'm thinking of like division as a thallergic state.
That makes sense.
Cell death, you know, thanergic. So if it is bursting capillaries, you're having some sort of trauma.
I wasn't thinking bursting. I was thinking like...
Oh, that's what I think when I think bruising.
Ooh, it's like the mechanism of a hickey.
The mechanism of a hickey. It's drawing.
A hickey doesn't necessarily break the blood vessel, but it draws the blood out.
Yeah, and there is a traditional Chinese medicine technique that also uses the same body response that sometimes leads to blood on the surface of the skin.
Cupping,
where they create negative pressure within little glass bowls, put them on the surface of the skin, usually in more like meaty areas of the body.
Yeah.
And sometimes you will get what looks a little bit like a blood sweat.
Yeah, that's exactly the thing that I'm thinking of.
We already have an example of a way that we can get blood just moving through our pores from negative pressure. I want to suggest that this is positive pressure.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So,
just like imagine having so much of this death energy that it's just like shoving the blood out of your tissues. It's actually pretty gross.
It actually is a little bit confusing to me, because I would assume that like one of the things that I've really loved about exploring death is realizing the energeticness and the creativeness and the fruitfulness and the like generativeness of death. And I guess this is kind of challenging that for me, where I imagine there being more outward pressure from a thallergic rush. part of that is assuming that the energy of Thanergy is like wilting, falling, vacuum, dark, pulling, rather than push. Yeah, I feel, to me, I'm coding in my brain Thanergy is a pull and Thalergy is a push, which is utterly arbitrary.
I would posit that corpses explode.
Corpses do explode. Corpses do explode.
What do you think of the moment at the very end of this chapter where Iglamine looks at Gideon with an expression she can't parse?
I think of when I am talking to someone who is 10 to 15 years younger than me, and I am watching them learn something that I have learned, and there is no way that I can share what I'm feeling with them without demeaning them. That's what that feels like for me, where it's like Aglemine is seeing a decision that she had her own crossroads around. She's seeing now the projection of herself onto Gideon come into a challenge, because she can no longer project herself into Gideon under these circumstances. And so there's all of this like care that is now nowhere to go. Like Aglemini has put so much investment in Gideon's skill because she sees herself. Maybe it's not that she sees herself. Maybe it's that Gideon's the only one basically competent and she was just exhausted with training Ordis. I don't know. But when I see that moment of Aglemini looking at Gideon, I think of the way I felt when people older than me were trying to give me their little bit of insight. And now being on the other side, beginning to be on the other side of that in a way that I can recognize. Like, there's a longing, there's a grief in it, there's a hope in it. There's like this hope that this lesson will be learned gentler. There's a fear in knowing someone who is so young and seeing, you know, their own recklessness and having learned the lessons of that in your body. Like, as someone who works with small children, something that I have to regulate is my body's reaction to their risk taking.
Mm-hmm.
You can't deny people their learning experiences, and humans are built to fuck around and find out. And like, Aglemini both realizes she doesn't have any control to intervene here, but also realizes that even if she could, it wouldn't do Gideon a lick of good. And that's sad. That's a heavy thing to hold about a kid that you have known since they were an infant.
Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley, and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is by Han Cayley. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's nunpod.com. And get our attention online using the hashtag nunpod. Thanks for listening.